And also, just to let you know that it's not possible to sign up for interviews if you want. So there's interviews possible. The first interview session will be tomorrow. So there will be alternative days of the sutta session in the afternoon. And the other day, there will be then interviews over there. So you can sign up for those if you're interested. But again, all of these things are voluntary. Okay, so now let us come back to the what this retreat is all about. So this is starting off with these suttas. And just, again, as always, I'd like to give you a little bit of introduction. Why to teach this way? What is the purpose of this? First of all, obviously, the purpose of this is to get a feeling for the word of the Buddha. How did the Buddha actually teach meditation? How did he teach the whole Buddhist path from the beginning to the end? It is so common for people to hear about all kind of meditation teachings, right? From this teacher, from that teacher, from everything. But it's very rare that we actually get direct access to the word of the Buddha himself. And of course, but if you really want to know what Buddhism is about, that's where you have to go, right? The Buddha, that's the origin of this whole thing. This is where it all started out. So if you want to know how to really do the practice, if you want to find out whether the teachings that you hear elsewhere are proper, are appropriate, are in accordance with how the Buddha taught, you have to go back to the source. It's the only way to really find out. And what you do, find out when you go back to the source, that there's so many wonderful teachings in there, so much advice, which is so useful and so practical, and about meditation practice, about how to live your life in general, but all these things, it is so useful and often so easy to understand. Sometimes people say that the suttas are so hard to understand, but I find it much more hard to understand all the teachers that go around traveling and telling you one thing and something else, and sometimes the opinions of different teachers will clash, right? And you just get confused. But actually, I find the word of the Buddha is often much more direct and very immediate, and actually, when you look at it, usually quite easy to understand, in my opinion anyway. At least if you focus on those basic issues that are important to most of us. So very useful. So once you kind of get the idea of why it is good to understand the word of the Buddha, the second question is, well, what should we read? What should we actually look at in these suttas? And what I will focus on during this retreat is a particular sutta, a particular discourse called the Gradual Training. And this is a sutta which occurs throughout, everywhere. In the Majjhima Nikaya, it occurs maybe 30 times. In the Digha Nikaya, another 10, 12 times. Majjhima Nikaya is a collection of suttas. For those of you who are new to this, Digha Nikaya is another collection of discourses by the Buddha. So this is a kind of a very standard way that the Buddha taught the training, right? The way he taught how to go all the way from the beginning here, from the moment you start out, all the way to the end. So it's a very standardized way. The Buddha taught this again and again and again, in different locations, to different people, with slight variations, right? When you hear the same thing with a slight variation, it expands your vision and your understanding of what's going on. And this is a very useful way of deciding what are the most important suttas. How do we decide that? And the way you decide that is that those suttas that occur again and again, that the Buddha taught to different audiences here and there, right? The things that he obviously emphasized so that everybody can hear, that must be the most important part of the Buddha's teachings. Right? So that's how we know. And it's gradual training because it occurs in so many places. It must be one of the most important things that the Buddha ever taught. There are a number of things that are like that, which he taught again and again, and I will point these things out as we go through these 9 days. But the gradual training is certainly one of those. So that will be the backbone of this retreat. And that I will start that sutta on the... This is the third sutta. Majjhima 27, the third sutta in this little compilation. So that we'll start that tomorrow probably. But before we even get going on the gradual training, I want to just bring out a couple of suttas that also show you the Buddhist path and show you the Buddhist path on slightly different angles, and they kind of give you an overview of the Buddhist path. So this is the again, the idea here is to give you an overview so you kind of see the whole, the bird's eye view, right? The eagle, the soaring and seeing kind of the whole landscape below. So you get this bird's eye view, and then you can put things into context and you can see how it all fits nicely together. And this is the idea with these first couple of suttas here. So these are this kind of alternative ways of looking at the gradual training, if you like. So this is the idea here. If you have any questions as we go along, what I suggest to do is just to write them down as we go along, and then we can do all the Q&A things in the evening. Apparently these talks are being recorded and somebody wanted to listen to them, and they asked if we could take the Q&As at the end instead. Okay, so let us then get going with the first sutta here. This is from the Anguttara Nikaya. The Anguttara Nikaya has one of the four main collections of suttas. You have Anguttara literally means something like Anga is like a factor, Uttara is further factor, and it's usually translated as numerical. So this can be translated as the numerical discourses. That's how Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi translates Anguttara Nikaya. So this is from this collection. And again, this particular sutta, one of the reasons I have taken it out here is because this sutta is a very common one. This particular structure that you see here is something you see again and again in the suttas, and for that reason is actually very important. Yeah. Okay, so I'll read it out and I'll comment on it afterwards. Bhikkhus, monks in other words, for a virtuous person, one whose behavior is virtuous, no volition need be exerted. Let non-regret arise in me. It is natural that non-regret arises in one who is virtuous, one whose behavior is virtuous. For one without regret, no volition need be exerted. Let joy arise in me. It is natural that joy arises in one without regret. For one who is joyful, no volition need be exerted. Let rapture arise in me. It is natural that rapture arises in one who is joyful. For one with a rapturous mind, no volition need be exerted. Let my body become tranquil. It is natural that the body of one with a rapturous mind is tranquil. For one tranquil in body, no volition need be exerted. Let me feel pleasure. It is natural that one tranquil in body feels pleasure. For one feeling pleasure, no volition need be exerted. Let my mind be concentrated. It is natural that the mind of one feeling pleasure is concentrated. For one who is concentrated, no volition need be exerted. Let me know and see things as they really are. It is natural that one who is concentrated knows and sees things as they really are. So that is the sutta. Very, very, quite brief. It is a little bit longer than that. You can see the little dots at the bottom there, which means that the sutta goes on. And that's why I have given you references there, so if you want to look it up yourself, you can. But this is the part which is most important for this retreat. And again, because this is the most practical part, the most immediate part, the one that is relevant for most people. And this is another thing that I think is so important with the suttas, is to make them practical, right? Make them something that you can relate to, something that you can take into your daily life and you can actually use in your meditation practice. I think one of the reasons why the suttas sometimes have a bad name is that often, like the couch potato Buddhists, they like to kind of hang out and argue or discuss about the suttas. And that becomes like intellectual Buddhism. And of course, the whole purpose of Buddhism is to practice it, right? Not just to have an intellectual understanding. And for that reason, it's important to be able to integrate the sutta readings with the practice. So that's why these are mostly practical suttas. So this sutta here, the way of understanding this particular sutta, and this is a point made by others, that this, what you're seeing here is really the psychology of meditation. Right? It's psychology of meditation, because this is actually what you experience as the meditation progresses. This is how meditation actually manifests in your own mind. This is what it feels like, or at least should feel like, if the meditation is working well. So this is the psychology, and it's a very useful thing, right? If you know the psychology, if you know what it's supposed to feel like, it's like you have a map, you have a guide, you have something to show you how things are supposed to move along as you go along. And this is what these things are like, in a sense, like milestones. You know, on the roads, you have this little kind of, you know, little things on the side saying so and so many kilometers to such and such a town. And this is like this, right? This is like so and so many steps away from Nibbana, right? So if you're at step 3 and Nibbana is at step 12 and it's 9 steps away, then you move on to step 4, 8 steps to Nibbana. And it gets more and more exciting as you move along and you're moving towards this. Because this whole thing progresses all the way to awakening. Awakening is the last step here. So this is the great thing about this. So it is a guide for something that when you do your meditation practice, you sort of look at this and you have some idea where you're at on the path, right? It's a very powerful thing here for that reason. So it's this is like the psychology of meditation practice. Before I discuss this in more detail, I just want to put it also in perspective to show you how this fits in with the rest of the other ways of looking at the Buddhist path. And the first thing I was saying is, of course, that this is an overview. It shows you how things beginning with virtue and ending up with awakening. And I just said before that the gradual training is a similar kind of idea. The gradual training is also where you start off from the beginning. You start off with hearing the word of the Buddha, and it takes you all the way to awakening. So the gradual training and this particular framework, which is the psychology of meditation, they overlap. They're two ways of looking at the same process. Slightly different angles, right? But essentially the same thing. And you can see that when you put them side by side, you will see that there is a lot of parallelism between the two. And this is one of the important things to understand about the Buddha's teachings. Everything is one view, right? Everything is one picture. These are not different things. They're all part of the same thing. So when you become the Buddha, when you have an awakening experience, all of these things are seen at the same time. These are all aspects of the same thing. So because of that, it's important to be able to match these things with each other and to understand them as part of the broader context. So when you see the gradual training, is a focus on what we have to do, how we should practice. So it starts off with gaining faith in the Buddha, right? Then it goes from having faith in the Buddha to how to apply that teaching that you have heard by being virtuous first of all, then by restraining and purifying the mind, then this idea of clear comprehension, moving towards meditation practice, and eventually coming to awakening. And this here, so that is the kind of the practical side of things, right? This is the experiential side of things. You see the difference there? One is what you're supposed to do. The other one is how you experience those results. So different angles looking at the same thing here. And then when you look at the gradual training, it says in the gradual training, as you progress for each step, step by step, it tells you that now you feel a particular type of happiness. Right? So when you are pure in keeping your precepts, when you are kind, when you're a good-hearted person, how do you feel? You have what is called the anavajja sukha. Vajja in Pali is like blame or fault or flaw in your conduct. Anavajja means the happiness that comes from blamelessness or flawlessness because the conduct is right. So that is the result of living a moral and kind life. And you can see again, this is exactly what you see here, right? The virtuous person, how do you feel? Well, you have no regret. So because you have no regret, you have joy, right? The same thing, exactly the same thing happening here. So these things overlapping with each other. in the gradual training, you find that as you move further down in the gradual training, you have the unsullied kind of happiness, unsullied happiness, which is the happiness that comes from having a pure mind as well. Not just your conduct is pure, but your mind is pure. So the happiness is no longer sullied by states of mind that somehow detract from the happiness. If you have too much craving or ill will, it detracts from the happiness. It sullies the happiness you have. And this, again, follows this idea you have here, whereby happiness increases and becomes more powerful as you move along. So you see the general trend, how these different frameworks of the path, how they fit together, and how they are part of a big picture. So that is how this is just very briefly to give you some idea of this of the Buddhist path, how it all kind of is part of one thing. Yes, and then of course then the gradual training moves on, and then you have the jhanas, right? And that is where here the samadhi comes in here, and then you have the seeing things concentration mentioned here, and then you have the seeing of things as they actually are, and this is also further down on the gradual training here. So that is about how this fits with the gradual training. Another important framework in the Buddhist teaching is the idea of purification, and that will come out more in the next sutta that I'm going to do. One way of looking at the Buddhist path is looking at it as a path of purification, right? You have this very famous work that was not written by the Buddha, but by Buddha Gosa, called the Visuddhimagga. Visuddhimagga literally means the path of purification, or the path of purity. And again, this here matches up with this path of purification. Everything in the suttas is about how to gradually remove the defilements, remove the negative states, so the mind becomes more and more pure, right? And so many suttas explain to you exactly how to do this. Now this path here, it may not be obvious, but what is going on here is that as you purify yourself, these states arise as a consequence of that purification. So you start off by being virtuous. So virtue is the first aspect of purity. So you purify your virtue, and then you find that a certain happiness arises as a consequence of that initial virtue that you have. Then it stops, right? You feel a certain amount of happiness and you sit down to meditate, and it goes to a certain point and you can't move beyond that point. So why is it that you can't move beyond that point in your meditation? Why is it that you feel a certain degree of joy and happiness, but you don't feel kind of the really big bliss, right? Or you don't even feel the medium bliss. You feel just a little bit of happiness and joy. Why is that? It's because the degree of purity only reaches so far. Then you have to ask yourself, how can I improve on the purity? What do I need to do to become more pure as a person? How do I need to think? How do I need to look at the world in a different way to improve my purity of mind in particular? And as you do that, if you are able to purify yourself, next time you sit down and you try to meditate, you feel the joy, and it goes a little bit deeper, because you have a little bit more purity. And that depth is what you see here. Not only do you feel joy, but you start to feel rapture, because the rapture is the next stage on this path. So as you purify yourself, you are going down the list of factors in this particular sutta. Purification and the degree of happiness that you experience are directly correlated to each other. One thing goes with the other. So it always comes back to this idea. If there's a blockage in your meditation, if it only goes so far, why does it only go that far? Because the degree of purity is only reached that particular level. You need to do more, and then this psychology of meditation, you will find that the depth of meditation increases as a consequence. So again, the correlation here between the psychology, what you experience, and the purity of your mind is very direct. So I'm just now kind of laying out kind of some broad outlines of what is going on there. And then there is another well-known way of looking at the Buddhist path, that is, look at it in terms of samatha and vipassana, right? We often talk about samatha and vipassana. And how does this relate to this particular set that we see here, this particular gradual movement of the mind. And samatha and vipassana, first of all, samatha is usually translated as calm, right? It means peace. And of course, one thing that you recognize here is that one of the factors you have here is tranquility. So obviously, tranquility and calm are very closely related to each other. A calm person is a tranquil person. These are basically synonyms in the English language. So what then is the difference? Well, the difference is that it's just a matter of usage of the words. Here, tranquility is used to narrow down a particular stage in your practice. But it's possible to say that the whole path is about calm, right? The whole idea, all of these things here, as you move down this list of factors, you're becoming more peaceful. You're becoming more calm. Everything is more peace. Once you are a kind-hearted person, that already makes you feel generally more calm than someone who is not kind-hearted. If you do meditation, and meditation works, you're focusing on the breath or whatever, makes you even more peaceful. And as your defilements decrease, you feel generally more calm in your general life. So samatha, calm, is this factor that goes throughout your practice from the very beginning to the very end. It's a relative factor, and it reaches its highest point when you reach awakening, but it's something that goes throughout the whole practice. So in this sequence here as well, as you go through the sequence, this idea of samatha becomes more and more powerful as you go through this. And tranquility is a particular stage in that development of samatha and development of calma. So what about vipassana then? What does vipassana have to do with this? Vipassana, the way I like to translate vipassana, is as clear seeing. I think insight is perhaps okay, but insight is too narrow, because insight is a particular thing that happens at a particular point. Mm-hmm. When you see a certain thing and you have like wisdom arises, that's really what insight is. In English, insight means, now I understand, right? But vipassana is broader than that. Vipassana is clearly seeing something here. And then insight or wisdom can happen as a consequence of that. And what you find again is that vipassana, the clarity of the mind, the clarity of your ability to see, increases as you go through this whole process, right? Just by being kind, just by being good, you're already having more vipassana. And as you move down, as your defilements decrease and your happiness, defilements decrease and your happiness increases, you have more vipassana, you have more clarity, you see things more clearly as a consequence of that. And why is that? Well, the reason that is because the defilements, you know, the anger, the desire, these are the things that distort reality. So the less defilements you have, the more clarity you have about whatever you're looking at. So clarity increases as you go down this path. So vipassana happens automatically as a consequence of this this development of the psychology of meditation here. So vipassana, samatha vipassana, happens right here. This, I think maybe one thing also that is kind of important to recognize here, that this sequence here doesn't say anything about the method, right? We're not talking about any particular method of practice. This particular sequence here is true for any kind of meditation method you do. It doesn't matter what it is. This is not about watching the breath or understand or reflecting on impermanence. In fact, both watching the breath and developing the idea of impermanence, both of those would be conducive to this particular sequence of mental phenomena to arise, right? So if you watch the breath in the right way, this is what should happen. If you are recollecting death, this is what should happen. If you are contemplating impermanence in whatever way, this is a sequence that should happen. If you are doing some other kind of meditation technique, this is what should happen. This is the psychology, and this should happen regardless of the type of meditation technique you're doing. This is not about meditation technique, but about the results, how it should be experienced. Okay, so there you are. So that is the ways of relating this to the other aspects of the Buddhist path. Now I want to look a little bit more in detail at this particular sequence itself. One of the things that is very outstanding to me about this particular sequence, so this is again how we experience meditation, right, is the enormous mentioning of things that have to do with happiness here, right? You're starting off and you have, of course, you have virtue first of all, then you have non-regret. Well, non-regret can be considered, I suppose, a type of happiness. And from that comes joy, right? Joy. Then you have rapture. Then you have tranquility. Well, tranquility is certainly something people want, a sense of peace, right? And then you have happiness. You have sukha, pleasure, it is called here. So one of the powerful things that you see here is this incredible emphasis of happiness, happy states of mind on the Buddhist path. And so meditation practice really is all about happiness. It is all about developing these good and positive states inside. And this is something that you see here. And that, of course, once you see that already gives you a very clear guide to how your mind should develop during a retreat like this, any kind of meditation retreat. Happiness is one of the essential qualities. And there's something wonderful, wonderful about that. We all know that the Buddhist path is supposed to lead to the end of suffering, right? And here we're talking about the other side, the flip side of the coin, the happiness side of things. And there's something very powerful about this, because it is obviously the case that for all beings, human, animals, or whatever beings there may be, that everyone seeks for happiness in one way or another. We're all seeking for fulfillment. We're all seeking for a sense of meaning. We're all seeking for a fulfillment of this craving and desire that always runs our lives. Why do we do things in life? What is anything in life about? And it's always, all the desires we have are there to reach a certain goal that desire promises us. Desire promises us satisfaction, happiness, all these kind of things. And of course, the Buddha comes along and says, you're looking in the wrong place. This is how you do it. And this is what this is about, right? This is how we find that solution to the problem that we've always been trying to find a solution to. The end of the fulfillment of what craving always promises us. Satisfaction, peace, and all these kind of things. So it's very powerful when this path, when the focus is so much on happiness. There's something very immediately attractive about that, right? We know that this is basically where we want to go. We know that this must be right in one way. That actually, this is what we've been searching for our whole lives. But remember that in meditation practice, because this is a very good guideline again for how your meditation should work. And if your meditation is not giving you this kind of satisfaction, this kind of happiness, at least gradually improving, you need to ask yourself why. And perhaps you need to change your approach or look at something, you know, how can you actually do things differently to make it work out so it gives rise to these things. And it is particularly important for this sutta because this is about how meditation is supposed to be experienced. This is precisely about these things. So please keep this in mind, and then you will you have a very clear guideline for what's going on. Now, another thing which is interesting here is how much happiness there is on the path even before you get to samadhi, right? Concentration here is samadhi. And this is kind of long way down the list, number 7. And there's all these other factors of happiness before you even get to samadhi. And this is important because people often come to a meditation retreat and they say, oh, I've come here because I want to experience the very, very, very deep states of meditation. Remember, there was one person who became a monk later on, and when he first arrived at the monastery, he said, I've given myself 2 years, he said, to attain jhana. That's why I'm here. And if I can't have it within 2 years, then I don't know what will happen. I'll probably leave again after that. But it's the wrong way, the wrong approach, right? If that is your approach, you're going to be very disappointed. It's not going to work out. In fact, the Buddhist path has so much happiness, so much beauty on it, long, long, long before you even get close to samadhi, even before you get close to these deep states of meditation. And this is kind of the thing about this path. So what you do, forget about the goals, forget about the results. What you do is just look at whether you are achieving a little bit of that happiness here and now. And if you are, you're already on the right track, on the right path. And what it also means is that the real achievement of samadhi, of deep meditation, is something very profound, right? It's not just ordinary joys and happinesses. It's not just the joy that you feel from having lived a good life. It's a very, very profound sense of happiness that comes from real, deep meditation practice. And that is important because you will often, there are discussions about what does it mean to have attained jhana, what does it mean to have attained samadhi on the Buddhist path. And it is something extraordinarily profound, and most people don't really understand that. And sometimes people say, yeah, I had a bit of joy in meditation. I wonder, was it jhana? Which jhana could it have been? It probably wasn't the fourth jhana because there's no joy there, but maybe it was one of the other jhanas, right? It's not that simple. It's not just about a little bit of joy in your practice, and that is jhana, that is samadhi. So the happiness starts long, long before that. And only when that matures into a very profound and extremely still kind of happiness can it be called real samadhi and real jhana. And this is the sutta which shows you that, right? It shows you all the happinesses that arise in sequence, one more profound than the other, until eventually samadhi arises way, way down the path. So that tells you, it shows you how profound samadhi is, and it shows you how much beauty there is on this path even before you get to that stage. So this Buddhist teaching is really quite quite amazing, isn't it? It's really something very special, the way it is kind of laid out in such details with such clarity and everything, and such very high emphasis on happiness, ending of suffering, and giving rise to all these kind of things. So that is the first thing about this, is the emphasis on happiness and joy. Then the second, there's a number of things probably to be said here. The second thing that I think is important here is that what we're seeing here is we're seeing a sequence, right? We're seeing a sequence of conditioned phenomena, one thing leading to the next one. So one thing happens after the next one. And of course, one of the points here that he is saying is that no volition need be exerted to go from one to the next one. Volition just means the will, right? It means the doer inside. You don't need to exert yourself. You don't need to actually do anything for the next stage to arise. It arises as a natural consequence of the former stage having been fulfilled. So if the next stage does not arise, it means you haven't fulfilled the former stage enough yet. You need to put more effort into the stage before. And then the next stage will happen as a consequence of the previous one. So this is a natural sequence that you see here. In fact, the translation here, no volition need be exerted, I don't think it actually, with due respect to Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi, who is a very good translator, having looked at it recently, I'm not sure if that is the best type, best translation. The Pali, rather, here, quite literally says that it says that this is not to be done through volition. That's quite literally what it says. So it's not that it need not be exerted, but it's not to be done by volition. It cannot be done by volition. It cannot be done by the will, right? That is a different emphasis. When you say need, it means, well, you can put a bit of volition in there, it might help out. But no, the point is it cannot be done by will. Willpower cannot give rise to this particular sequence. The only way that this sequence can arise is by putting in the basic factors, and as a consequence of those basic factors, the rest of the sequence will happen as a natural consequence. That is what it's saying. So it's a very powerful statement. So what does that mean in practice? Well, what it means in practice, if you want to find out why these things are not happening in your meditation practice, And I'm sure that most of you will probably be able to say that all of these things are not happening, right? I'll be very impressed if you get all these factors coming together. I'd be very, very impressed with you. And it would be wonderful, of course, and I would be very, very happy as well. But why is it only stopping at a certain point? Why is it only go so far? And if it is a natural sequence, then you have to go back to the very first one, right? It's the very first one that is the important one. That is the one that sets in motion all the rest of these things. So the problem then is virtue, right? That is the issue that we have to deal with. And that is what this says. And the rest is a matter of not doing anything. There's no exertion, no volition, no will being required at all. In fact, the will is superfluous. The will actually gets in the way here. The will is not going to be able to do anything here for the sequence to actually work out. So put the will aside and go back to the beginning and ask yourself, is it possible for me to be more virtuous? What can I do with my virtue? So this is what this sutta says. Forget about the will. Put in the basic factors. So what do we mean by virtue on the Buddhist path? And the Pali word for virtue here is sila. I'm sure you may have heard the word sila used many times before. And sila in Pali is much more than what we normally mean by virtue in English. Virtue in English often means that you should not be doing this, you should not be doing that, this is bad, etc., etc. That is also part of sila, right? Is to avoid the negative things. Don't treat other people badly. Don't say bad things about others, right? This is kind of the basic. This is what we all know about already. But the word sila means more than that. The word sila often means something like habit, right? Almost like character is what it means. So it has more to do with our whole person, our whole personality. What are we like? What is our character like? Are we kind of generally good-hearted and kind people? Is that our character? Or is our character, different from that? So it is a development of the whole character that is meant here by the idea of sila. So in other words, yes, it includes avoiding the negative, but it also includes the development of the positive qualities, right? Don't do the bad, but do the good stuff, right? So these are two kind of opposite sides of the same coin. I'm going to talk more about this tomorrow, hopefully. And then it also means, because character is also about our mind state. What is our mind state like, right? What is your general mental outlook? How does that feel? What is your general attitude towards life? That also is part of this. So sila here is very, very broad. It includes all of these factors, goodness, badness, and also the mental world. And that is why, of course, because it is so broad, you can now start to see why this becomes the foundation stone for everything else. And a large part of what I want to do on this retreat is to talk about how can we develop, in particular, the mind. How can we learn to look at the world in a different way? How can we learn to kind of nudge the mind in the right direction, that there's more kindness there, there's less upset, there's less kind of all these negative things, less desire even, and move it towards the wholesome, peaceful states of mind instead. So this shows us where the work needs to be done, right? The work needs to be done at the point of virtue, the point of character, the point of habit. And the rest is an automatic process. And this shows you why when somebody like Ajahn Brahm, when he teaches meditation practice, he says, don't do anything, right? He says, just sit down and let it happen. Now, if you haven't done the first factor and you try to follow Ajahn Brahm's method, nothing is going to happen. And you're going to say to Ajahn Brahm, it doesn't work. Your method is not good. You're useless. Why isn't it working? And the answer is very simple. It's because the groundwork isn't powerful enough yet. That is why it doesn't work. I think sometimes Ajahn Brahm, he forgets that how many of us, we have more defilements than he has, right? When he forgets that, he says, all you have to do is just chill out. You just sit back and you have a good time and you just allow the happiness to come. Okay. It's great, but this tells you why it works or why it doesn't work. And the reason it doesn't work is because the foundation stone is not powerful enough yet. So that is what that is about. It is no volition, no will, no effort should be or can be exerted to give rise to the next factor. Volition here is superfluous. In fact, it is usually gets in the way because volition is the opposite. The will is the opposite of the tranquility and the peace of the mind. And that is why it says here, it is natural. The word for natural here is dhammata. Dhammata means something like in accordance with the Dhamma, in accordance with nature, in accordance with the laws of the world, that this sequence happens all by itself in this way. So let's have a quick look before we round off this one, a quick look at the factors here, what happens. So once you have that sila, once you have the virtue, once you have the right character in place, non-regret arises in you. And we know, I think we all know what regret means. Regret means, oh, I shouldn't have done that. That wasn't such a good thing. You know, I shouldn't have said that to this person or whatever. But the idea of non-regret here is much more profound than that. You find that if your mind is not bright, if there is a kind of a slight kind of dampening of the brightness of the mind inside of you, that dampening of the brightness in the mind, that is a consequence, or it's an aspect, if you like, of this idea of non-regret. It's like the mind is held down. The mind is, by the lack of virtue, the mind is kind of held down, and you feel kind of confined. The mind isn't expansive. The mind isn't bright. And this is an aspect of this idea of non-regret. And as you, what happens as you are able to purify yourself, it's almost like you are cutting the chains, right? You're cutting these chains that are holding you down. It's like a balloon which is allowed to soar when the sandbags are cast off, right? And then the balloon soars. And the sandbags of our life are all the defilements in the mind, the defilements of our conduct. When the sandbags are cut off, the mind soars all by itself. And this is what's happening here. And this idea of non-regret, the mind feels brighter, it feels lighter, it feels more beautiful. And this is the consequence of this idea of virtue. So when you have that non-regret, then joy arises, right? You think back to what you have done, and it's almost automatic. You feel a sense of gladness inside of you. You feel glad about your conduct. You feel glad about your life. You don't have to, this is not something you have to force. And I will again talk about some of the suttas later on. I talk about this in a bit more detail, what this actually implies for our meditation practice. I'm sure you know what that means, but sometimes you just feel glad. You come here to Jhana Grove, it is peaceful. You see the beautiful sunset and the sunrise in the morning. You're with good people around you. You've done what is right in your own life, and you just feel a sense of uplift, right? There's a kind of the heart feels light and easy, and you feel a gladness. And this is what gladness is about. And then this gladness, as you practice the meditation, this gladness becomes more and more profound, and you get the rapture arising. And rapture is often felt in a physical sense in the body, right? It's like this kind of wave is going through the body sometimes. It is a deeper sense of happiness that comes as this deepens, becomes deeper and deeper and deeper. And then as you move along, and this again is just to give you an idea of the psychology that happens here. As you move along here, the happiness becomes in a sense greater and greater, but the calm also becomes deeper and deeper. That is why as the rapture starts to kind of become more peaceful, that's why tranquility is the next stage, because you're becoming more and more calm. And at the same time, the happiness is more profound and more beautiful and more delectable at the same time. And that tranquility then leads to an even more profound sense of happiness. And this is the sukha on the path. The sukha means basically, it's a general word that means happiness in the Pali. It's a kind of profound, very profound, deep sense of satisfaction. At this point, there's almost no craving left in the mind, right? The mind is very pure. And when there's no craving, it means that you are completely satisfied in the present moment. There's a very deep sense of contentment. And this is why this happiness that comes after tranquility is so deep, because you are content. Tranquility means peace, no craving. You're right here and right now. You feel a deep sense of peace, a deep sense of happiness. And you can see that from that, because of the depth of that is when samadhi, here translated as concentration, And if I use the word concentration, and Ajahn Brahm gets to hear that, then I'm in serious trouble. So he doesn't like that. And I think a good way to deal with that word is actually not really to translate it at all, but just to leave it as samadhi. Because samadhi has a very specific meaning on the Buddhist path. It just means the mind which is still and unified, right? Which is happy and content within itself. And there's no movement anymore, completely unified with the object. And this of course is the interesting thing, only then, after samadhi, this sutta says, only then can you see things according to reality. Only at this point is your mind pure enough. Only at this point are the defilements abandoned enough that you can see things in accordance with reality. And when you start to see things in accordance with reality, that's when you get liberated, right? You see suffering, you see impermanence, you see non-self, your whole view of the world is changed, and that is how liberation comes about on the Buddhist path. Okay, so that is a few things about this sutta. I find this sutta very inspiring. And again, just to remind you, the reason why I'm reading this one out, one of the reasons I find this very useful, is that this particular structure, this sequence of things, is something you see in many, many places in the suttas. The word of the Buddha includes these things again and again and again. So this is one of the very important ways that the Buddha taught his teaching. For that reason, it is very important. So, there you are. That is the sutta on volition. It's a very rich sutta. There's a lot in there. And all of these things, remember that these things are what you are supposed to experience. Take this as a map, right? Take this as the milestones. Remember this and check your own experience against this particular map. And then you will know roughly where you're at and how things work out. It's a very powerful and useful sutta. Okay, so that's all I want to say for this morning. So please, if you have any questions, again, please write them down. And as you write them down, then we can take those in the evening between 8 and 9. I will then be answering all these questions at that time. And in the meantime, we will also have another sutta session between 3 and 4. And otherwise, just please keep on enjoying yourself and having a good time. We'll see you later on.